Hi, everybody. Before we start the episode, this is a quick technical note for people who listen to the podcast on an application called Stitcher. So, of course, if you're listening to this, you know there are a lot of different podcast distribution apps floating around out there. The big ones being Apple, Google, places like that. But a lot of people listen to the show on an application called Stitcher. It turns out you may or may not have gotten the notification, but the Stitcher application is going to disappear on August 29th, 2023. It's going to go away, right? So if you depend on Stitcher to listen to the Climate Minute, you want to start making plans now. If you listen to the Climate Minute on any other application, you're good to go. No worries. That's because, well, it's convoluted, but we post the show to a website called Podbean, and that Podbean distributes it to the podcast to Apple, which then funnels off, and everyone else, all the other applications, receive the podcast from Apple. Therefore, if you don't use Stitcher, no worries. If you do use Stitcher, you need to get a different application. I'll put up a link to the frequently asked questions file from the Stitcher people. And there you go. Stitcher seems to be pushing the application called Pandora, which is a music streaming app. We have recently posted the Climate Minute to Pandora. So if you take their advice, you can go there and maybe that becomes your new app. I've also personally moved over to something called Good Pods. We'll see how that works for us. For my own personal listening, it turns out that within Stitcher, if you're in Stitcher, you can download a list of all the shows you like and that you listen to, and you might be able to import those to the new application that you choose. Anyway, there you go. Just a heads up. If you listen to the show on Stitcher, you need to find a new app. If you listen to the show on anything else, you don't need to listen to this because you're fine. Okay? So, good luck. Oh, by the way, if you have an application you like and can't find the Climate Minute there, send us an email, podcast@massclimateaction.net, and we'll do our level best to get the show on that app as well. Okay? There you go. Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source of insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. This show is for the week of August 3rd, 2023. Today we'll listen to another edition of Making Sense of Climate with our good friend Steve Sherlock at Franklin Matters. We talk a lot about stuff going on in Massachusetts. The show is recorded in mid-July of 2023, and I hope you enjoy.
And it was interesting, we finally did see a news article after we came back. Phoenix has actually starting to implement slowing down their growth because they are recognizing they don't have enough water to continue to sustain the growth of the path that they were on. Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet, WFPR.FM, and in the local Franklin, Mass. Area FM dial, in the car, in the home, anywhere you are, 102.9. Here today with another Making Sense of Climate session, and it's been a bit. Ted, welcome back. How are you doing?
Good, Steve. How are you? As they say, it's been a minute, but here we are. Things, the worm has turned and we're back. Huh?
You know, we try to get away from this, try to distract ourselves with other things, you know, family events, travel here and there. And we just can't avoid climate. It's around us almost every time we turn.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And in some cases, the headlines are getting scarier and scarier.
Well, there's a bunch of scary headlines. But on a personal note, I had over this last period, I've had the good fortune to fly. I was in Italy. Okay.
Italy.
And climate sin, right? I flew over there. I had my, you know, sort of one flight for the year kind of thing, but we were there and it rained every day a lot. And even the local people, to the extent that I could understand things, we're saying this is really weird, right? That there's and it's a climate issue in that the, you know, the jet stream gets set up because of the extra heat, and then it just gets locked in and keeps pumping either hot or rain or cold or whatever. But there were we were near Venice, and there were floods in northern Italy where people were dying, and the river through went to Florence. The river through Florence, there were people in Florence kayaking on the river, the Arno, I guess it's called, right? And they're kayaking because the flow is so high.
Wow.
And it's just, you know, so I mean, it's like climate touches everything, even when you're even when you're trying to get away from it.
Yeah. No, and we took a trip out to one of those, you know, I want to see the Grand Canyon. So we flew into Phoenix, got up to Sedona, got to see Grand Canyon, got to see Monument Valley, Bryce Canyon, Zion. And we finished in Las Vegas. And clearly Phoenix, for people, if they haven't been, it's expanding. It's continuing to grow. Las Vegas, the name itself comes from the water source that they had that dried up many, many years ago.
Really?
They're totally dependent upon the Colorado River, et cetera. And that's a big discussion out there because clearly when you go to Lake Mead, in order to get to your boat, which was docked at Lake Mead and, you know, nice, you know, 10 foot off the shore, now it's like a quarter mile because the lake has dropped so much. Lake Powell, the lake has dropped so much. It's just, and they don't do kind of tours up the canyons because the water level has dropped so much.
Just remind me, Steve, the Lake Mead and Lake Powell are man-made lakes.
Lakes, two separate ones. Yeah.
From the damming of the Colorado River. And the Colorado River, of course, is this infinitely famous Southwest American thing that goes from the Rockies all the way down in Los Angeles or something, right?
It goes into the California Baja.
Yeah, it is drying up. I guess that's the headline there.
I started looking, you know, it's like, okay, how far does it go? So yeah, that's how far it goes. Goes to Baja, California. And the flow by the time it gets to California is almost not insignificant because it's been diverted in so many ways. And the Supreme Court and other agencies have been, you know, wrestling on a bunch of legal matters because everybody's trying to drink from the straw. Everybody needs more because they're growing and they got to come to an agreement. And it was interesting. We finally did see a news article after we came back. Phoenix has actually starting to implement slowing down their growth because they are recognizing they don't have enough water to continue to sustain the growth path that they were on. That is a good step, but that doesn't necessarily help address the growth that's already underway, the growth that's out there. And
Vegas, the lack of water that already exists.
Lack of water that already exists, right?
There was a book that I have started called The Water Knife. I put it down because it was too upsetting. But basically, it's set in some dystopian future where there's no water. Right. And what's Los Angeles going to do if the Colorado River goes dry and all these? I mean, it's going to lead to deep societal conflicts, right?
Oh,
that people fighting over water. And it's, right now we can kind of cluck and say, oh, yeah, isn't it terrible the Colorado River's drying up? But pretty soon that's going to be a life and death situation for people.
Right.
And it is a hint of the kinds of things that are happening. Again, not to get too, you know, prophet of doom kind of thing, but I mean, this is a real thing. It's happening now. It's like, please pay attention.
We need to recognize it. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even in New England, of course, with the headlines recently, the torrential rains plus that went through Vermont, the capital is flooded. Yeah. It's going to take years for Montpelier to come back to being a functioning city. It's going to take months for some of the residents to get their lives back to order if they choose to do that there.
It's funny. You wouldn't think that Vermont is a particularly vulnerable climate place from a climate perspective.
Interior, absolutely.
It's interior. Yeah. But what happens is that if the storms tend to bring more water, again, prediction of climate change, warmer air holds more water, you get more rain, things slow down, again, prediction of climate change, the weather patterns move more slowly. And Vermont is, of course, mountainous, the Green Mountains, right? Mm-hmm. And all those valleys collect the water, and it goes rampaging through, and there you have all these issues. And so 9 years ago, Irene, right? Remember?
Yeah.
I can't believe Hurricane 9 years. Irene. It seemed like just yesterday. But, I mean, that was this horrible thing, and now we're redoing it. And that's just one example of multiple things that are happening. I mean, Texas has been broiling. There is a report. I just wanted to mention, there's a report that says, I think it was July 3rd was the hottest day ever recorded. We'll come back to what that means in a minute. Right, then July 3rd was, then July 4th beat it.
Right? I think it ended up being what, 7 or 8 days in a row?
In a row. And the folks put out a map, which is basically not a map, a chart, which is days of the year across the bottom and temperature on the vertical axis.
Yeah.
Right. So you get this kind of big bell-shaped curve. July's in the middle, it's the hottest. And they have each year, you can plot overlapping. And lots and lots of years that are all kind of grayed out. And then 2023 is, you know, separated. And now, wanted to be sure to note that people can and are shooting at this hottest day ever recorded, because the headlines are somewhat confusing. It's a place in Maine, good faith, academic place in Maine that uses models and does this prediction in real time, right? Because like NASA and NOAA, they do it on a monthly basis, that the average temperature on a monthly or a year, they don't say, oh, yesterday was the hottest day on the globe, right? Because how do you even get all that information in one place, to do? But they are able to use models and make these predictions. And the recorded history that they're referring to is, I think it's like 44 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's not that long back. But then it gets, there are other measures that it turns out that we are the hottest, if by other measures, the hottest now in something like 10,000 years.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm sort of hung up on exactly how people define hottest day or blah, 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 is because the bad guys can say, it was hotter than this a million years ago. You say the hottest day ever recorded, you know, what do you mean? You guys are all Chicken Little, right? So it's very specific about how hot it is, but we are now hotter than we've been for 10,000 years. And that 10,000 years essentially covers all of human civilization, from, you know, people running around with blue paint on their faces, right? Yeah. Long, long time ago to now, and we're hotter. So there you go. Just be careful when you quote these, know what you're talking about when you say hottest day ever, because, you know, the people will take advantage if you're not specific. But short answer is it's hot. Hot as blazes out there. So.
Yeah. And even that there was some recent stats of, you know, the water temp in Florida, you know, exceeding 90 degrees. Okay, so you can't go refreshingly swimming down there. I mean, we complain about Maine being 45. This is Florida is 90? Excuse me.
Well, it's really an interesting thing. It's like everyone's had the experience of when you have a bottle of seltzer, right? And it's warm. You've had it at room temperature. Open it, and all the seltzer fizzes out, right? Psh, it all comes out. Why is that? It's because the gas, the carbon dioxide gas in the seltzer, cannot maintain a solution at the temperature of the bottle of water. So when you open the thing up, the pressure, all the pressure changed, all that. Same thing is true if you have 90 degree water. The oxygen comes out of the water because the oxygen can't be in solution in the water at 90 mm-hmm. degrees,
sure.
and all the fish die. Yeah. So you have these massive fish kills as the water, you get dead zones from hot. Again,
yeah.
there's a catalog of biblical plagues you can keep going through about how yeah. bad things are going to be. But it's, I guess the question I have is, when do the biblical plagues get people to wake up? Right? At what point do people, does it click that we are the frog in the kettle that's slowly warming up? I mean, when as a society do we jump out?
Yeah, the canary in the coal mine, supposedly. I mean, this is the warning, or is it too late for the warning?
Yeah.
Are we, according to some prognosticators, we're behind time. On others, at least, you know, there's still time to take action. But
there's a subtle form of climate denialism which says, "Oh, it's too late. Don't bother mm-hmm. to do anything, you know, enjoy your life."
Mm-hmm.
And that's not where we are. I think that right now we're fighting for every tenth of a degree. But I mean, I keep coming back to the, you know, how, as climate activists, how do you make the case for climate action when people can see these things, devastating events, and still blow it off?
Mm-hmm.
So say, well, it didn't happen to me. It can't be real. Or those poor people,
right.
too bad for
right.
them, but I'm going to be good.
Yeah.
No.
It's not going to happen here. And it's supposedly every 100 years, but they're already now saying that every 100 years because of the change, maybe actually every 37 or 40 years,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
We're still, I think, on the one hand, fortunate for where we are here in Mass in New England, but we're going to have our challenges as well. And the heat certainly is going to be one. I would think at some point, you know, if we got 10 inches in an hour, yeah, there's going to be some floods around here too.
Yeah. No one is. It's just a matter of time before things catch up to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That's a kind of a downer. I mean, listener,
yeah.
sorry to be a buzzkill, but I mean, it's a great summertime. But man, I think the upshot is always comes back to action being the antidote to despair, right?
Yes.
Do something. Yeah. Do whatever it is you want to do. Who, you know, call your congressman, write a poem. You know, go stand on the street corner with a sign, talk about it to your neighbors. You feel better when you do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's where, thank you for at least helping me make sense of climate so we can at least take some action instead of just beating our head against the wall and getting a headache. Such as it is.
But there were some good good things here in Massachusetts these past few weeks.
Come back to that and kind of focus on, okay, everything else is happening. We understand that.
Bad things happen.
We understand that. But oh, by the way, let's try and figure out how we can do something here.
And it turns out that one of the interesting things that has recently come across my timeline, as we say nowadays, is that this Massachusetts state government body, right? The Department of Energy Resources, DOER, which mm-hmm. if you're a climate person, you'll hear that word more and more frequently. DOER released a report in which they went, I guess they used GIS, all this magic GIS stuff about mapping.
Yep.
And they were able to take every parcel in the state of Massachusetts and rank it by six criteria, like, does it get enough sunshine? Is it wooded? You know, could you put a solar panel on it? Is there a lot of biodiversity? Right, stuff like that. Is mm-hmm. it, could it be connected to the grid easily?
Yeah.
And they've ranked every parcel as to how much solar panels could be put on that parcel. Right, and it turns out that there's a huge amount of places that we could put solar, like 500 gigawatts. Which, trust me, that's a lot of solar panels.
That's right? A lot of power.
But that for the very best, the ranked class A ranking, which means, as I say, you're close to an interconnect, you've got a lot of sunshine, you don't have any snail darters running around in the, you know, underneath the solar panels from an environmental perspective, et cetera, et cetera. You could put up 52 gigawatts of solar panels on those prime locations without particularly disturbing any natural ecosystems.
Mostly
and that's a
rooftops,
good thing.
I think, right?
It's mostly rooftops, and I think that, I mean, 52 gigawatts is more than we're currently contemplating for all the wind. I think we're talking now about like 36, 38 gigawatts of wind offshore. 52 gigawatts is a whole lot of power.
Yep.
Right? And so that's a good thing. And we'll put the links in, but what's cool is that you can go to this thing. I have done it. I think my house comes in as like a minus or something, but you put in your address and it will tell you how this thing ranks your address for solar capacity. It's like an action. It's like if you want to feel better, at least you can say, gee, I could put in solar panels. Hey, I got a pretty good place. Maybe I'll think about that in the great by and by of putting in solar panels on my property. And so that's a good thing. It's a good thing the DOER has done it, and come back to how good solar is in a minute. I guess the fly in the ointment for me on the DOER report, which is written up by both WGBH and W and the Globe, the fly in the ointment is that they did not include any kind of environmental justice ranking on the sites. And
oh, so they excluded that kind of financial impact data. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and if you look at so there's this color-coded map of the state in the article, right? You take a look at it, and if I remember correctly, the blue parcels are best for solar. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that, all of the blue parcels tend to be in urban areas, right? And so Boston is all blue. Franklin's not very blue. Springfield's blue. Lowell's blue. Down near New Bedford is blue, right? And so of course, urban areas tend to overlap sometimes with environmental justice communities that are already got a bunch of junk that they don't need, right? And so while I laud the DOER for a good tool to find out where these solar panels could go, we should be talking about environmental justice from the very get-go. Because if you don't, including it later gets harder and harder and harder. And then at the end, you're building this thing in the middle of, you know, some poor guy's backyard, and he doesn't want it. And you say, well, you know, we should have talked about this at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So now is the time to at least think that, you know, bucolic green communities. Like, I'm not even sure where Franklin, I have to look, but Franklin has got the big solar panel array out near on Union Street. There are places that, and it's an interesting question is, do you want to put solar panels on a green field? Why would you do that?
Yep.
As opposed to putting it, say, on the top of the Walmart or something.
Sure.
Right?
I can see putting it up on a roof, especially in one of the many cities that you listed. The roofs in the cities, that makes a whole lot of sense because of multiple connection capabilities. You're maximizing space. It's out of the sight, out of mind. Many of the buildings are taller anyway, so you're not going to see it. There's not going to be any impact there. And by the way, there may be an economic justice piece because they are city, and that's kind of what their environment is. There's a proposal for part of Maplegate to get converted to a solar farm through the planning process. The ones you referenced, there were two that the Abbey has up off Union up at the end, the Mount St. Mary's Abbey, I think, or whatever the Abbey is. I forget the name. I'll have to fix it for the recording. But the nuns have it, and that effectively, we were one of the purchases of their power output. So Franklin benefits from that green electricity, a la solar. That's one of our primary sources of electricity that the town uses. From that perspective, as you've heard and we've discussed, we have municipal aggregation, which a contract was bid, which we got 10.75 kilowatt hour rate for the prior years, which expires in October. And Jamie announced during one of the budget sessions, the new rate, I think, is going to be 15 cents. So clearly still less than what National Grid had come out with and Eversource at 34, 35 something for the winter. Mm-hmm. Theirs may still be a little bit in that neighborhood. We don't know. But at least ours going forward for the next 3 years will be 15. Yes, it's more than 10.75, but in the market space, it's still going to be lower than what we anticipate others are going to be.
Interesting. Well, there were two points I thought it would be interesting to make regarding things like the solar panels near the Abbey on Union Street. Mm-hmm. So this is a big used to be like a big field. You could graze your horses.
Part of farming, farmland. Yeah.
Part of farmland. So there's two different directions. One is that down on in Wareham on Cape Cod, somebody wanted to put solar panels into what used to be a cranberry bog. In order to, they would have to scrape up all the topsoil and put the, and people opposed it. Right? He says, why destroy this relatively working ecosystem? And sure. I kind of hear that, right? Flip side is, or a different idea is this concept that I've seen pop up more and more called agrovoltaics, where it turns out that solar panels are very compatible with certain crops and animals. That is to say, if you put solar panels on a field, you can have butterflies and bumblebees underneath them.
Oh,
happy,
yes.
Happy, happy, happy.
Sure. Right?
And in fact, there are some crops, I forget the specific ones, but that can tolerate the shade. And the challenge is to put the voltaics kind of on a PV things on a like a 10-foot tall stand, which increases the cost, right? So if all your full photovoltaics are up 10 feet, but now the cows can walk underneath it and graze, and they get a little shade and they in the hot sun, right? So the compatibility of photovoltaics with working farmland is a subject that is growing, and I think really makes your heart happy, right? The idea that we can take care of the butterflies and the bumblebees with and generate solar power at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Yep. Yeah, because clearly there's obviously a cost benefit, but I think the long-term benefits would be beneficial to my mind. But yeah, I'd let the experts do some of the numbers on that for sure.
Right, right. Well, I guess the last thing about solar panels to note is that we're going to talk more about ISO in a minute. ISO, the Independent System Operator of New England, ISO New England, are the guys that basically operate the grid for the six New England states. Because we're so interconnected, right? No one state runs the grid. ISO New England runs the grid. For various reasons, ISO New England is distinct from ISO New York, which is a separate organization that runs New York, because New York's pretty big, right? Curiously enough, there's no extension cable, so to speak, between ISO New England and ISO New York. There's no way to transfer power back and forth.
And this, I just can't send you a few watts.
And, and then it turns out New Jersey, which of course is hard by New York and part of the same, they are part of yet another organization. I think it's called PJM, which is the Midwestern equivalent of ISO New York and ISO New England. Anyway, long and short of it, ISO New York, ISO New England, and New Jersey have gone to the federal government to ask for help in building what are called interconnections so that ISO New York can feed power into ISO New England and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So if there's an emergency in ISO New England, you get power from ISO New York and vice versa. Yep. I mean, it's such a crazy idea that it just might make sense, right? It probably should have been done a long time ago. But the idea of this interconnections is a big deal in the world of electric grids, and this is a first step. And the reason it's important is because as we continue to electrify everything, our vulnerability as a society to electrical blackouts gets bigger and bigger.
Sure.
Right? If your car is electric and your induction stove is electric, everything's electric and the power goes out, you're in deep doo-doo, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to have reliability go hand in hand. And this kind of interconnection is important. And so that's a good thing. And then the last sort of dovetailing of ideas here is that we talked recently, or there's a report recent about what's called a backbone for wind, offshore wind. So now here's the idea that from Massachusetts is going to build a bunch of wind turbines. New York is building wind turbines off Long Island. New Jersey wants to build wind turbines off New Jersey. And basically up and down the East Coast, there's a lots of people think about putting wind turbines off in the water. So there's this idea that says what really ought to happen is that all of these separate wind farms are connected by what's called a backbone cable, a big cable that runs from wind farm to wind farm. And then that power is brought on shore at a few selected places. So it's cheaper, you know, it's cleaner to do, et cetera, et cetera. But also gives you more reliability, because now if something happens in New England, maybe there is power off New Jersey that can be brought in, and we can get to switch this stuff around at low cost. So there's lots of really exciting ideas about how to build the sort of clean electrical future that we need to think about. And of course, it's all very nerdy and sort of, you know, people's eyes roll back on their head when you talk about this stuff too much. But the electrical grid is an interesting thing, because it's very much important to our lives.
Well, and I think, given respectfully, it developed over time. There probably wasn't, quote, the master plan even back in those days. The master plan was more limited in scope. And because ISO is also part of a regulatory agency, the regulations, a la Congress or whoever, said, this is your place to play. And there was limitations on it. So now that people are starting to say, but we need to do this, some of those regulations are going to have to also change to allow those kinds of connections, which, yeah, they make a whole lot of sense. Let's trade when we need to. Obviously, not every time, but we, at some point in time, somebody's going to need to. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting – it's I think Senator Markey from our fair state, Senator Markey, climate champion, has a bill somewhere in the Senate, right, probably languishing in some committee somewhere. But that bill would explicitly put climate concerns and clean energy onto the mandate of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and by implication, all of these ISO New England, ISO New York, that they, in addition to just being cheap and reliable, they also have to be clean, right? And those things, that's a good thing. And that, to your point, I mean, as we go forward, something's got to give, right? These regulations that grew up in a different world need to change to accommodate the new world that we're in.
Right. Yeah, because I think we touched upon that, because ISO was not allowing some of the wind power because it was, quote, too cheap, and thereby in their calculation didn't fit into the model. And it's like, wait a minute, it's too cheap for them? Come on.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, there's lots of arcane stuff associated with the grid, but it matters to us.
And I know we had talked with our Rep. Roy, Representative Jeff Roy, in one of our prior episodes, and he had had a chance to go visit a nuclear plant. And nuclear is still, clearly it's in the mix. The question is how long we keep it in, or at some point does that other modular concept really become viable? That's, at this point, I'm not sure where that should land. When you talk green, okay, it's not fossil fuel, but the life cycle of a neutron is a little bit longer and more dangerous than I think some of us would want to play with. So,
yeah, I mean,
healthy discussion.
It's a good discussion, and I think it's a legitimate discussion, because there's a distinction we need to make between existing nuclear power plants and proposed nuclear power plants.
Correct.
I think at this point, no one's talking about building new power plants like the Pilgrim Power Plant in Plymouth or anything, right? Mm-hmm. People are talking about things called small nuclear reactors, which basically are about the size of a container, you know, the shipping containers that you're well familiar with.
Yep.
It's that size. I'm extremely skeptical for various reasons that we don't need to go into right now, but small nuclear is another scam, right, that to make a lot of money for the people who are technically adept. But there are nuclear plants that are running, right? And you can say that, and I agree with you, that the radioactive waste is damaging, but to the extent that they're running, they're not making any carbon dioxide. And if you shut that nuclear power plant down, you're going to have to probably fight about building a gas-fired natural gas plant to replace it. Right? And so why would you do that? On the other hand, there is this moral quandary about why would we continue to let a nuclear power plant run, generating this toxic waste that we're going to have to deal with for 10,000 years, another 10,000 years. It's a tough one. And I think that it bears a lot of discussion. Although, in my humble opinion, we don't want small nuclear reactor. We certainly don't want new nuclear reactors, because they're just not going to be there in the timeline for us for what we need. So, one of the things that I found extremely entertaining was an article you came up with, Steve, on the small wind turbines.
Yes.
What did you see in that?
Well, it was interesting because, I mean, most folks have traveled, some more extensive than others, but you kind of have also, especially even in New England, you have this iconic image of a farm, you know, maybe with a silo and the red barn. And periodically, there was also kind of a wind turbine to provide, in many cases, it seems to have been more kind of pumping power, et cetera. But these days, that technology could create electrical power. And that kind of concept. So potentially each home could have their little wind turbine. And again, some locations, maybe they'll come up with a DOER, will come up with another wind map in terms of which wind locations are better than others. If you're down in the valley, maybe not so good. If you're up on the hill, maybe better. I'll do all that kind of analysis. But the wind certainly is here, sometimes more than others, and that might be an option.
I think that sort of wind turbine you see in the movies with a lot of slats, many slats, and the things whirring away, pumping water out of the well. Yeah, I mean, the wind turbines most efficiently want to be big, right? The bigger you can make the wind turbine, the better. And why is that? I mean, there's lots of reasons for it, but a wind turbine, if you think theoretically, is basically – the blades of the wind turbine define a circle. And you can imagine that there's this kind of this long tube of air, the same diameter as that circle, that's rushing towards the wind turbine, right? Mm-hmm. And the energy that the wind turbine can extract is the amount of energy in that air, right? And so it makes sense that if the wind turbine blade is bigger, there's a bigger tube of air coming and there's more energy you can catch more. And it's really interesting. I mean, I read something about it years ago, but I mean, there's a theoretical maximum that you can get about 30% of the energy that's current, that's in that wind. You can extract about 30% of that into electricity. And you say, well, why is there a limit? Well, in the perfect case where the wind turbine took 100% of the energy out of the wind, the air would stop on the other side of the wind turbine. Ooh. And just be sitting there. So the incoming air would have no place to go, right? So you kind of have to have – the wind has to – you know, your optimum is to have the wind keep going and vacate the behind the wind turbine so the new wind can come in. Very interesting stuff. Long and short of it, a small wind turbine that you might put on your house probably can't define a very – big tube of air, right? So it can't really get much energy. And they tend to be, in the past, they tend to break down. They're kind of noisy. Not everybody wants to be next door to a thing on the roof of their neighbor, right? But there's certainly, apparently, with new materials and whatnot, there are places where, like you say, solar panels and farms, you know, agrivoltaics, you could put a small wind turbine up there to power the house. It's comparable to the solar panels. And what's nice is the wind blows at night. So you get the power at night that your solar panels can't produce. So I thought, and I guess there's enough money now behind it to try and have something of a resurgence. And if the technology can keep up, I mean, I don't think you're going to have a wind turbine on your house, right? And I keep thinking, sometimes you see sailing boats with a little wind turbine in the back. Right? That's just barely enough to keep the radio going, right? That's not really any power. But I think that there are settings where a small wind turbine would be sort of analogous to solar panels. And that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. I mean,
interesting. I was also putting the connection together because you mentioned, I think it was 30% would be about the max for the wind to generate the electricity. Isn't it even in the solar, they're actually just now starting to get into the 32% efficiency, which is, you know,
it's really interesting stuff. Yeah. I'm not sure I can reproduce the exact physics of it, but it's like, there's only a certain wavelength of the light. So the light that comes in is a prism, right? It goes from red to blue, and you see all the colors, the yellows in the middle. Well, the solar photovoltaics are only sensitive to a certain color in there. So maybe they're only sensitive to the yellow, right? And that's
a piece of the range,
not a piece of the range, right? And what's happened recently Since you mentioned it, I'll go down one more path. There's this material called petrovskite, I think it's called. It's a mineral, and it is sensitive to a different – it's like the petrovskite's sensitive to the blue, and the silicon photovoltaic sensitive to the yellow. And so they kind of overlay them, and they can collect more power out of the out of the sun, right? But still in all, it's still only about 30% of the sunshine, that, which is why, to my mind, if you have a – and I don't know why they haven't done this yet, so – you can patent it if you want, but the solar panel should be combined with a hot water heater, because 2/3 of the sunshine could go into your hot water, right? And then 1/3 makes the electricity, and the other 2/3 of the heat just warm up your water as a precursor to going into your home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're tapping literally into that, and maybe not fully getting all the benefits of hot water, but you get warmer water before you actually formally heat it. You're still making the system overall, the system being the key piece, much more efficient.
And what's the last step on that is that if you were to cool your solar panels, they run better. But if they sit on your roof on a hot day, they get hotter and hotter. They begin to be slightly less efficient. Mm-hmm. And so if you can cool them by heating your water in your house, it's a win-win.
Yes, because now the water going through is actually being diverted. The heat within the water is being diverted. Wow.
Carried away.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Interesting concepts.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things we can do as we kind of close up, because there was a bunch of articles, and we'll include those in the show notes, but our prior episode, not formally officially as part of the episode itself, because it was video based. It didn't officially get out into the podcast, but it is available. Was this conversation we had with Dave Rittenhouse talking about Energize Franklin. And these are kind of the steps that we talked about to go back in the beginning, that the individual actions can be an antidote to the despair that, you know, the world's ending, it's going to be terrible. Individual actions can come together, and at least we can do something. So we'll put a link into the video. It's about 45 minutes or so. It walks through some screenshots of various opportunities you can take. We've talked of mass save, getting an energy audit. He started getting testimonials from various people who have done solar installations.
Right, and what Energize Mass is it's a website, right? So it's a website that you can kind of join, get an account in. And once you're in the website, you can look at what other people have done in Franklin. And there are suggestions of things you can do in Franklin, new ideas of stuff you can do. And then you can basically, it's almost like a competition. You can get points for doing some of these things and see what your neighbors are doing. And it's a very good way to at least learn about the options of what you can do and kind of connect with other people in Franklin that are doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. So it's a great website to go take a look at. And Dave was kind enough to walk us through on video, and it's there. You can check it out, right? Yeah. As they say.
Absolutely. And potentially explore one of those options, whether it's an electric vehicle, even eating a vegan burger instead of a beef burger.
And it some of the steps are so simple. I would emphasize that it's like eating one less meat meal a week is a significant step. Right? You don't have to eat vegan burgers all the time. Right? You just say once a week, I'm going to have I'm not going to have that piece of meat that I would have had. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal. It really adds up fast. So
yeah, and in these days of terrible headlines, at least we're trying to do something. That's right. And I thank you for helping me make sense of climate as we take this journey together. And for the listeners, quick reminder as well: we do this because Franklin matters. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening.
For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tintype Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. And by the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.
So there you go. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.